And we're just about right on time. North and Falcon in-season management, this is a briefing. So, Pat, I will turn it over to you and George. Yes, yeah, Commissioner Carpenter is going to kick it off.
What I wanted to say, this is a situation, this in-season management that's in place in many of the Puget Sound fisheries currently. And there's a great deal of stakeholder pressure to review that and take another look at the way things are done. And I felt it was really important to get these gentlemen to brief my colleagues on the commission, because it may be a situation that you're not aware of, and hopefully that we can get some current news on what's happening, what might be able to be done. And so it's my pleasure to introduce George Harris, president of NMTA, Pat Patillo, recently retired from this fine hall, and Kyle Addicks. So take it away, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Smith, commissioners, Director Unsworth. I guess I don't need to introduce us now, so thanks for the introduction, Commissioner Carpenter. As you said, this is an issue that's very important to a lot of our stakeholders. It's also a fairly detailed into the depths of salmon management. So I'm going to just give a couple introductory slides that I hope will tee things up for you. So each year we sit down through the North of Falcon process and plan salmon fisheries throughout the state, and those fisheries are planned based on preseason forecast of abundances and conservation objectives. So we're trying to plan fisheries that will allow fishing opportunities around the state and meet all of our conservation objectives, and there are a lot of those objectives. For most of our stocks, we don't know when fisheries happen if our forecasts were right. So we're implementing those fisheries based on the preseason forecast. So marine area fisheries proceed on the assumption that those forecasts are right and that we can implement those fisheries without putting our conservation objectives at risk. And there are two main ways where we can implement those fisheries. One is a fixed season. So we say we can go out based on past history and implement this season. There'll be some variation on what actually happens, but we're confident that we can have that season without risking not meeting conservation objectives. We use that for a lot of freshwater sport salmon fisheries and a lot of Puget Sound marine sport fisheries. The other way we can implement those is to have some expectation for what a season is, but then do in-season monitoring and close that season if we meet the catch or encounter limits that were modeled for that season pre-season. The ocean salmon fishery is an example where we have quotas. We monitor the fishery. If the fishery hits the quota, we close down. Also in Puget Sound, we have marked selective Chinook fisheries where we monitor the fishery in season, and if we reach some encounter mortality limit, we take action to close that season, even if we thought preseason it would last longer than it actually does. Pat has a lot of history in this, a longer history than me, and he has some slides and thoughts he wants to present.
Will you be my technical wingman over there?
I will.
Change those slides for me. Thank you very much. Yes, my history, it doesn't seem like it was 20 years ago that we began the program of mass marking and marked selective fisheries, but it was 1996 that we had a lot of stumbles and we had a lot of restarts, but initially getting mass marking going was a big challenge because it was such a fundamental change in the way we produce fish and manage our fisheries. We really didn't get going with Chinook marked selective fisheries until 2003. And recall that the listing for Puget Sound of on Chinook, the ESA listing, was in 1999. Fisheries at that time in Puget Sound, sport fisheries and commercial fisheries, were virtually all closed. commercial fishing had been eliminated for Chinook, and sport fisheries were down to, I think in 99, we might have had a two-week season in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a fishery that once caught 50,000 Chinook salmon. In the sport fishery, just in Area 5 alone, was down to just a couple thousand fish, not a selective fishery at that time. So the challenge to fishery managers was, how are we've got all of these Chinook salmon that are produced from hatcheries, Coho too, but I'm focusing on Chinook now. We've got all these, this production, all of this investment, a tremendous cost to the state. How are we going to catch these fish? How are we going to derive benefits from it? And the possibility, just the possibility, it had not been tested in any marine fisheries before this time, was to implement these marked selective fisheries. There was so little known about the outcome. We had state, tribal, technical investigations and workshops, and we had international committees that worked on this, and we made our best guesses about what the possible outcomes would be. But there was a lot of uncertainty about these fisheries and how they might come about, whether or not the very important technical aspect or the management aspect of our Chinook fisheries coast-wide, the coated wire tag program, could be preserved. And many of you remember the difficulties we had in implementing that, a concern broadly for marked selective fisheries was technical in nature. We developed with the tribes then a management plan that began with the first of the marked selective fisheries in marine waters in Area 5. It was in the summer of 2003, and given the uncertainty about that fishery, about even how many people might participate, would it be popular? Would people go to a destination place like the Strait of Juan de Fuca and fish for Chinook when they had to release maybe up to half of the fish? And could we pull off all of the information, could we collect all the information needed to do stock assessments, because it's all about wild fish? It was a fundamental change in the way that we sampled fisheries. We had to shift to a more intensive sampling. We couldn't just rely on shore-based sampling at the ports. We had to put people out on the water. We had to collect information about what was released, not just what was caught. In that year, in 2003, and the subsequent 5 years, through 2007, we collected all that information, and we wrote so many reports that the stack was this high. When we finally, in 2007, made an assessment of whether or not we were successful. We were successful in terms of the technical information collection. It was successful in terms of popularity. And it was successful in this way. We had an in-season management obligation that we, part of the agreement with the tribes, that we reached each year anew. We set it for about 3,000 to 5,000 landed fish, and we weren't sure whether or not that was going to be enough to get a month or a month and a half fishery, but it was in most of those years. And by the time that that information was collected and we knew the nature of the fishery, we felt that we were confident, we meaning the tribes and the state, and we were able to eliminate the in-season management application for that fishery, that first fishery, which was called a pilot selective fishery. So that was a great success. In the interim, we'd been working on the application more broadly. And so we implemented fisheries in the winter. The first ones were in areas 8-1 and 8-2. And those were by separate agreement, and the nature of the fisheries required a separate sampling program. The sampling programs are tuned into the unique characteristics of the fisheries. We expanded to areas in the summer, areas 9 and 10, a huge big deal in 2007. And that fishery, very popular. And the ability to gain access to Mid Sound and South Sound hatchery Chinook was a huge and fundamental change in our fisheries, the access for sport fisheries. So we were beginning to see this expansion, and And quickly, moving forward then to the current times, we have 17 individual times or areas that are depicted here that have marked selective fisheries, and every year in the North of Falcon process, this is how it's evolved with our agreements. We have individual agreements that describe the sampling programs for those fisheries. So, for example, Area 7, a sampling program tuned into the specifics of the island. And the development of in-season management, especially when we had new fisheries and didn't have the history. Let me hit the next slide there. We had moved to a management for in-season controls that we thought might be necessary, particularly when we weren't sure about our predictions of the outcome. Now, what's important about the outcome? The bottom line is conservation. Our conservation objectives for the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan, the state tribal co-manager joint plan that's submitted to and has been accepted by the National Marine Fisheries Service for a permit to have these fisheries conducted, is built on stock-specific exploitation rates, limits on the proportion of the stock that can be taken. So we make the estimates in the preseason using the computer model, the Fishery Regulation Assessment Model, FRAM. We have those estimates, and we have them for each individual fishery, and we have reached agreements in recent years to use a statistic that would be monitored with the sampling programs. That would be, for example, with Area 7 during the winter in 2016-17, the fishery that's going on right now or has been temporarily interrupted this winter. The fishery would be controlled by a prediction for the total number of Chinook encounters, not just the landed fish, but the fish that are released, not just the unmarked fish, the wild fish, but also the sublegal fish. Sublegals, legal size, marked and unmarked. All of those added together, total encounters. That's what's depicted in this graphic in the red. We predicted with the FRAM model those numbers beginning in 2011 for this example, Area 7 during the winter. In the first years of this, then we went out and we made estimates during the season, and that's the blue line here. And so you can see that in 2011 through 2013, we had no problems. But in 2014-15 and this most recent year, we've had an intersection of those, a convergence. And the two features of that, the reasons why those have converged is, one, the information about the fishery with which we use to input to the FRAM model has given us ability to be more accurate with our preseason estimates. Well, the problem with that accuracy is now that you've got very tight, accurate estimates of preseason, the natural, normal, or the sort of the innate feature of recreational fishing, perhaps fishing anywhere, is that fish move. There are more or less in any one time period. And so even when you're using this FRAM model, it's predicting and it's accurate, but it's got variation. So particularly with the breakup into nine individual in-season management plans, it's not unusual or unanticipated that about half of those just randomly would be over, because you've got to be either over or under in your predictions. So it's expected that you'd have these in-season management convergences and a greater frequency of this occurring. But what else is going on here? Let's take a look at the encounter as a statistic. We think that encounters, that total number that I described of all fish, may not relate to directly to what's the bottom line. It's about the fish that are killed by the fishery. The great advantage of the marked selective fisheries is this. You're releasing fish with a high proportion of them surviving. Adult fish are released and 90% of them will survive. Juveniles are released and 80% of them will survive. So this statistic, this blue line, this that looks alarming, an increase in the number of encounters is largely made up of sublegals and the entire amount of encounters that's been increasing, that might actually be a good sign. It might indicate that there are more fish out there than were predicted, either sublegal fish, juveniles for the next years or future years. But Chinook having that complex life history, it's our view that a better statistic could represent the bottom line, conservation line. Hit that one. Here is total mortalities compared to total encounters. If you look at total mortalities, that's related to that exploitation rate conservation objective directly, and it's a lot more stable. It doesn't show a big increase. It doesn't show that change, particularly in the last few years. Next slide. So if we converted instead of having a total encounter metric for this, we think that we could avoid this convergence, this frequency, the risk of changing fisheries or having this effect of closures in season. And that's really the nature of this problem. There are two problems. One is about the fishery. Are we meeting our fishery objectives? The other is about the conservation objective. So I hope I've conveyed to you the reasons. And this is just an example with Winter Area 7. It's true throughout the Puget Sound fisheries. I tend to think of the sport fishery in Puget Sound as one fishery. Think of it as the fish are one. They move around a lot. The anglers certainly move around a lot. And the history of this fishery is one fishery, people making a choice throughout the year, moving. It's a mobile fishery for the most part. And yet its foundation is the businesses that are the infrastructure of this fishery that supports and relies on a stable fishery. We don't have a stable fishery at this point. That's a problem. So let me hand this over to George, and he'll comment on that problem.
Just to understand your mortality statistic, is that the exact number of retained fish, or does it take into account that 10-20% of non-survival when they're returned?
Yes, Commissioner Thorburn, that takes into account that. It's the collected information of all of the encounters and then applied to those that are released, the release mortality rates that are separately for legal-sized fish and sublegal fish.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth, Deputy Director Storr, for the opportunity to be here. As Larry said, I'm George Harris, President of the Northwest Marine Trade Association. We have 700 member businesses across the state that build, sell, store, repair recreational boats and fishing boats, as well as all the businesses that contribute all the goods and services that those boat owners need to use their boats. And our partner association, the National Marine Manufacturers Association, will tell you from their research that 70% of all boats are used for recreational fishing all or some of the time. So think about it this way. There's 240,000 recreational boats in Washington State registered, so 70% of those are used for recreational fishing all or some of the time. And then in totality, recreational boating and fishing in Washington is a $3.2 billion industry. And then another number I think that surprises people is 95% of all the boats nationwide and in Washington State are 26 feet or smaller. They're on trailers. These are the boats that move around. They're not in the marinas. They're in the driveways all over the state, eastern Washington, western Washington. So I've given you a packet with 8 slides, and I think these slides show a really interesting, helpful case study on just what happened last year, the negative economic consequences of the unprecedented uncertainty we had with our fishing seasons last year. And this is really troubling for me and our member businesses, because recreational salmon angling, particularly in Puget Sound, we fish selectively, and we embrace it, we support it, as Pat has talked about. And thanks to the investment that the state has made into marked selective fishing and hatchery production, it's there. And these businesses and anglers just need the opportunity to go. So in the slides, Slide number two, if we can have that come up on the screen. I wish I had a header on this slide, but this shows 15 boat manufacturers located in Washington that make up the bulk of Washington new boat sales. These are all over the state. I think about this, and I think Florida is probably the only state with a comparable level of in-state boat manufacturing. And all of these happen, almost all of these happen in rural communities, and they provide some of the best jobs in their communities with family wage salaries and full health insurance. So I like to think of the boating and fishing industry in Washington State as sort of a self-contained ecosystem. And that ecosystem is completely dependent on recreational fishing opportunity. So slides three and five show the detailed sales data that we receive from the Department of Licensing every month through a partnership with University of Washington Sea Grant. And what I like about this case study is, you know, we all hear all sorts of economic studies, you know, the direct, indirect, and induced activity and whatnot. And sometimes it feels a little vague. But this is really, really concrete data that we get from the Department of Licensing on every new and used boat transaction in the state. And we can, like on a slide like this, see where those boats are sold and how they're manufactured and where they're manufactured and that sort of thing. If you move along a little further in the slide deck, we summarize this, and we can see that slide five shows that for 4 years, right after the Great Recession, Washington State, we led the nation in new boat sales by percentage increase from 2012 to 2015. We were outpacing the national average by 2, 3, and 4 times with our new boat sales. And then this all changed in 2016. And in my mind, really the only thing that changed in 2016 is the uncertainty we had going into our summer. And, you know, as soon as April, May, June, as soon as there was this idea that there wasn't going to be any opportunity on the Columbia, on the coast, in Puget Sound, everything started to change for our member businesses. So the graph on slide seven shows that following the 2016 Seattle Boat Show, which our organization produces, last year, new boat sales, this is in February and March, they were up a solid 15% in the first quarter. But starting in May and for the rest of the summer, new boat sales slowed significantly and dropped below 2015 levels. So the whole rest of the country, they're selling boats 5 to 10% better than the year before. Previously, Washington State had been leading the nation, and then all of a sudden, we're now doing the worst in the nation. And you can see the graph there, that purple line, I was fully expecting it to go up over the top of the green line, and it just didn't happen. And if you were to go back and look at some of the other data there, you could see that historically, pre-recession, as an industry, we were selling about 10,000 boats a year. This is still only about a 5,500 level that we're at. So, you know, we should be able to get back up to 10,000 new boats. And we just kind of got stopped in our tracks spring and summer of last year. So, like I said, this is all about not having any predictability. So if you're a boat manufacturer over in Clarkston, or you're a boat manufacturer up in Bellingham, you just can't predict. You've got labor you have to plan for. You've got materials you've got to plan for. And then if you're a dealer, you've got labor you've got to plan for. If you're a destination, if you're a tackle shop, and again, these are Washington businesses. This isn't stuff that gets ordered on Amazon and shipped in from overseas or anything. This is Washington businesses. So then the last slide in the deck is just a real simple calculation. I did have this checked with an economist, and he says it's simple, but it's truthful. And you know, the average value of a new boat in Washington is $42,000. Used, by the way, is $15,000. You extend it times the 1,000 new boats that weren't sold last year, that's $42 million. That's $4.6 million of tax revenue that the state missed out on, not to mention all the indirect and induced activities from all those boating activities. And I think, as Pat has made the point, we have these hatchery fish. We just need the opportunity, the predictable seasons to go after them, enjoy this great state that we have, enjoy this opportunity. So, thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hold the applause until we're finished, please.
No, hold it always. we don't, this isn't a rooting gallery, so I appreciate your emotions and concern, but it is inappropriate for boos or yays.
I had a couple things I want to add.
Good job for a youper, too.
Thank you, guys. It's probably no surprise to anybody that I've been in the business, the recreational business, for 35 years. I'm soon to be retired, and so I'm going to miss some of that. But the reality of what I think needs to be reiterated is the expectation for an opportunity. There has to, when you're dealing with the general public, that most of which have jobs and have responsibilities, they have to know what their seasons are. And it becomes even more important when you go, and like George spoke about, the manufacturers and the dealers, you have to buy all this product a year in advance in order to have it available for sale the following year. So whatever we can do to provide the certainty is crucial. And I just want department staff to be thinking about ways to do that, because the other thing that happens, and I see it because I'm located up in Mount Vernon, is the migration of Washington boaters out of state. When we have a situation like this where an area gets closed, I-5 northbound has got a lot more boats headed for the Canadian border than we normally see, and they're going to go fishing somewhere. And if we keep them at home, they're buying fuel, they're buying tackle, they're buying equipment. Obviously, conservation is key, but I think we have the tools to manage conservation and opportunity at the same time. So,
any other commissioners' thoughts? Yes.
Thanks, Pat, and good to see you again. Look forward to seeing you around the North of Falcon always. So two questions. Hey, this is all great stuff. Why don't we just go ahead and do this? I mean, what's the rub, I guess? I mean, go ahead.
Thanks, Commissioner Kehoe. Yeah, I'll expect to see you in those hallways too, huh? What's the rub? Well, I think what it really gets down to then is perhaps is a recommendation or a way of going forward. You know, how, if you agree that the problem is serious and should be addressed, we know that it's not as simple as just doing it. It's particularly from the state. It's the partnership with the tribes. And what I tried to convey in the presentation about the history, and it would take a lot more to describe how difficult it was to reach agreement on those marked selective fisheries and the intensity of the debates technically and from the policy perspective, the strong feelings of suspicion on the part of the tribes and even beyond the tribes about whether or not these fisheries are the right thing and can do the job, or do they really improve our ability to manage for primarily our conservation objective? Well, particularly in the atmosphere that we are in currently with the North of Falcon process, the obvious need to reach agreement to make a major change in a year like 2017 and negotiations going on right now, difficult, undeniably. But maybe starting with a specific proposal, that would be a place to start, and I think it's important to see it as a at least making progress as soon as we can, maybe by making these same arguments with the tribes. And so while I believe that particularly with regard to the conservation objective, I believe that we are meeting that. I believe that we could meet that with seasons. And I do not think that the evidence is there to point to the sport fishery as contributing to any fault, any problems. We know that there are some problems with the management plan the state and tribes have. National Marine Fisheries Service called that out again this year to the tribes and the state in a letter to you, Director Unsworth, a repeat from the last couple of years that there are some stocks that are having problems. But I think that same evidence that they pointed to, including the recent work with the FRAM model, shows that we've done a really good job overall, and sport fisheries are not a problem. But nevertheless, being practical and realistic and thinking of this make progress, and I suggest that an alternative to the current situation could be this, that one, we take a look at winter fisheries, at least just those mark selective fisheries that are occurring in the winter. They produce 40,000 angler trips a year, and the total mark selective fisheries in Puget Sound produce about 100,000 angler trips. Translated to economic benefits, that's somewhere around $3 million for just the winter fishery. So focusing on those, the evaluation of in-season management could be, instead of on those individual fisheries where we have this year 7 of 9 tripping their thresholds, why not consider it as a single fishery for the winter of areas 5 through 10? If you consider that, and you also use this metric that's mortalities rather than encounters, lowering the risk of tripping the in-season, and for the logical reasons, it makes sense. You also then incorporate a kind of action-response buffer. That is, you know that this precision of your estimates is problematic and that you're always going to trip that with some fisheries, or even the combined fishery if you were able to convince the tribes to agree to that. But have some sort of a buffer that relates to the natural variation in the fishery, the ups and downs, which could be a statistical calculation. So like 20%, we actually had that incorporated in some of the agreements last year, a 20% buffer. Use that so that you're not reacting too quickly and that you're also stressing that you want to get through that season. And then finally, maintain WDFW's discretion on what the measured response to tripping that threshold is, rather than a prescriptive, you will close, taking some measures to dampen rather than close would be preferred. And if it was examined as all of these areas together, then making a choice based on perhaps which stocks were at greatest risk in this particular year. Maybe it's the Dungeness stock this year or Nooksack Springs. Maybe you choose your response based on that, but you have the discretion to choose and try to maintain the integrity of the fishery. If you create, here's a problem, if you create this closed, open situation in the future, you won't be able to use that year that's got these openings and closures as a reasonable average with which to input to the model in the future. So you're throwing away data by not having representative fisheries. So trying to maintain the integrity, a choice of the department through its own discretion, being responsive but a measured response, and looking at the fishery as a whole. That's a proposal to work with, rather than something that simply get rid of in-season management. Long-winded, sorry. I don't.
Yeah, and just a quick follow-up. I mean, I just look at this, right? So you the red line is the estimated mortalities, and that's kind of the what you're advocating for, is we use that instead of the FRAM model. I mean, I just look at that, and I mean, it looks like the either the FRAM model is biased high in terms of mortalities, or I guess maybe the people that don't like using this in-season estimate would say that this estimate is biased low, right? I mean, it's consistent. Mm-hmm. If it's random, you would think that, you know, you would see fluctuations both ways, but this is consistently, you know, your estimate, it's consistently lower than the FRAM model. So have you looked into that? I mean, is there something tweaking, maybe something wrong with the model? I don't know, but it's consistent.
I think I'll just skip that one. I think one of the points to be made is that Recently, the Fram model has undergone a complete new base period and an upgrade. And so the tool is thought to be, for everywhere that it's used, in the ocean for PFMC, it's endorsed that this is an improvement, and it's necessary to always make improvements, but it's the best model that it's available. I don't think anybody's really looking at this particular fishery, even just Puget Sound. It's applied, as I said, in the ocean as well as inside, to freshwater fisheries and marine fisheries, tribal and state, etc. So I don't think anybody's looked at a bias with respect to this feature of it. But one thing that you should know is that one of the most difficult predictions, this is based on abundance predictions. It's all pre-season predictions until a couple of years afterward we have the ability to assess what the actual run sizes were. So delayed post-season estimates are available, but not anywhere near the fisheries occurring. And we can look at the details of that. But one of the more difficult forecasts is the very young fish. We don't directly predict the age 2 sublegal fish of these populations. We don't have a database for them. We use whatever we see in age 2 fish to try to predict age 3, 4s, and 5s, but the adult fish, but we don't have good estimates of age 2 fish. It's apparent that in recent years, the number of sublegal fish has actually been a lot lower than was predicted in some of these areas. Not every area, but it's a volatile component of that, and I think that's what we're seeing here. Essentially, the difference there in the most recent year, 2016, is correcting for sublegals, or the fish that are released, and the largest component of the released is the sublegal fish. Okay. That's just one thought.
If I could add, in response to Commissioner Kehoe's question, and this is Pat's graph, but the preseason projections were based on what was modeled and the seasons that were modeled. The estimated reflect any changes that were made in season to the season. So in some of these years, the actual season was altered using in-season management, so that changed the outcome.
You know, this subject matter is deep and long, and there's a lot to learn, a lot to learn. We could go on for hours, but I would propose that that unless there's any objection by my colleagues here on the commission to urge the director and staff to evaluate this concept and see what pathway we can find forward to solve this, because it is a real draconian way to try and manage on behalf of our stakeholders, and those of which we're going to be asking for more money for license fees and stuff. I think it's worthy of some consideration by the department. Soon.
I agree. Definitely. That sounds like a no-brainer to me. But there are costs, and obviously we can't do everything, but I think this is a very high priority. But I wanted to speak to something else related to North of Falcon. And whenever I listen to Pat, I'm just impressed by the wealth of his knowledge, experience, the complexities. I get lost, frankly. I can't absorb it all. And I think I am not different from a lot of the people who care very much about how the North of Falcon process comes out in the end. So while I applaud what you're trying to do and want you to go forth and do good on behalf of our fishers, I think there's another element that's also necessary, which it's hard to describe in ways that, you know, this is a sensitive topic, but it has to do with the general dynamics of the negotiations in recent years and the feeling that we're not getting the best deal that we can. and we have to find better ways to be strong, assertive advocates for our state's fishers. There is, there's, I think, a lot of people here wanting to understand what's happening at the North of Falcon process. We talked about greater transparency, and I think there's ways to bring greater light to the process. You know, we've talked about how many public meetings we have in the various regions in the run-up to those final deal-making meetings when the doors close. And you just then it goes blank, and that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where people start feeling like they're left out. There's no transparency when it matters. We give them tons of transparencies until that point in time. Now, we recognize that we can't force the tribes to open those doors, but I think there's other things that we can do. And I think we've got to try to do that. So one of the suggestions, specific suggestions, is that we engage the commission more in getting regular updates about the kind of response you're getting to in-season management. The process just began for this year, officially. I don't know that we had planned to have North of Falcon updates every single commission meeting, but I think that would be a good idea just for everybody's education and for transparency. So go forth and try to get this in-season management agreed to, but if it's not being agreed to, come back and tell us why. Tell us the roadblocks you're encountering. And then I really do think that if we can't have our citizens viewing these final meetings in which deals are cut, we got to explain to them in detail what happened and why we ended up agreeing to what we ended up agreeing to, and all just the facts delivered in very professional, neutral, objective terms. But if we're getting a raw deal, I mean, I know that people suspect we're making concessions not based on conservation need. We're meeting conservation needs, but we're still giving up some fisheries. And it's not clear why. But if it's just because some of the tribes are extracting unnecessary concessions from us, we need to know. And if it's revealed, maybe the dynamics will change. So I wanted to make a pitch for let's keep working on this transparency issue, because it's not going to go away. There's a lot of people out there who are wanting to understand why we do what we do, and I think we owe it to them to tell them.
Thank you, Commissioner Recker. We understand the transparency issue. We work very hard to engage as many constituents as we can through those negotiations. Just from a logistic standpoint, when we're meeting in California, we're on the phone with people, updating them on what's going on as often as we can, understand the frustration, and we're doing everything we can to keep people informed. Back to the in-season management topic, last year was a very different year for North of Falcon. The way things happened, we spent a lot of time dealing with the coho crisis, didn't make progress on in-season management, and our meetings in Vancouver last week at the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting, we told the tribes that we've discussed it before, we want to discuss it more. As Pat knows, we've put a lot of proposals before them. It's a really tricky issue. We've got fisheries in multiple areas that are impacting multiple stocks. A lot of those stocks are in critical status this year. Figuring out how we can adjust fisheries in season or not, and make sure that we don't exceed any of our, we don't put our conservation objectives at risk, it's a tricky issue. And we have told the tribes we want to talk about it more this year, and we will.
Yeah, thank God. It's
It's really the only fisheries in Puget Sound or around the state. I mean, there's in-season management on the ocean fisheries, but in Puget Sound, the only in-season management that's operated and managed this way is a recreational fishery. And it's an economic... conservation is really critical on all the fisheries that you guys manage. But the economic piece is, I just want to reiterate how crucial that is to many, many people.
So I think, Director, you heard consensus is from what the Vice Chair said. Okay. Is that it? Yes.